It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll get two perspectives on abortion and how things have changed in a post-Roe Wisconsin. Now, general election season is officially underway in Wisconsin ahead of the midterms this fall. Marquette University Law School is out with its first poll since last week's primaries. It shows Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes leading in the race against incumbent U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, and the governor's race between businessman Tim Michaels and Governor Tony Evers. It's a lot closer. We're talking about the big key races in Wisconsin and how Wisconsinites are feeling about a number of issues this election season. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What issue matters most to you in this year's midterm elections? Do you know already who you'll be voting for in November, as many do? If you're still up in the air, what do candidates need to do to persuade you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's co-founder of pollster.com and founder of pollsandvotes.com. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into results, the usual disclaimer: these results are not a prediction, right?
Nope, they're our estimate of where things stand in August at this point. And we'll be doing three more polls between now and the election. And even the last one will still be where things stand before the election. The voters will have the final word on that on election day.
All right. All that said, the race for governor, one of the two big statewide races here in Wisconsin this year. What are we seeing in this first post-primary survey?
Quite a close race. Evers at 45, Michaels at 43. A two-point margin. The independent candidate on the ballot, Beglinger, is at 7. The margin of error here is 4.2 percentage points, so that two-point margin is clearly inside the margin of error. That is a tightening of the race from June, when Evers had a 7-point lead over Michaels. So Michaels hasn't enjoyed 5 points of tightening in that race since June. That's where the primary campaign probably helped to introduce him to voters, build his name recognition, and tighten that governor's race.
Now, you ask what people think of candidates in some different ways. What do we know about, you know, how much people have formed opinions about the incumbent, Governor Evers, versus the challenger, who, as you say, is just getting his name recognition now? How much is still up in the air with either or both of them?
Yeah, and this is a big difference between incumbents and challengers this fall. With Tony Evers, only 12% say they don't know enough or don't have an opinion of him to say whether they have a favorable or unfavorable view. But with Tim Michaels, that number is 34%. Now, with Michaels, that's down from 56% in June. So, again, over the summer, people learned about Michaels, but there's still just over a third of the electorate that haven't formed an opinion of him versus just 12% that haven't got an opinion of Evers.
Okay, that's one big statewide race. How about the race for U.S. Senate? We've got Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes challenging incumbent Republican Ron Johnson.
Here again, we see a primary bounce, but this time the bounce is for the Democrat, whereas in the governor's race, the bounce was for the Republican. Barnes is leading Johnson by 7 points, 51 to 44. That's up from just a 2-point margin, 46 to 44 in June. I think it's interesting that from June to August, the challengers got a 5-point bump in both of these races, but a 5-point bounce for the opposite parties. Yeah, and it does show that primaries can be good for a candidate, even if they're hard fought the way the governor's primary was, and a quiet ending to the Democratic primary. In both cases, those challengers seem to have benefited.
Now, I've seen some reaction to your survey along the lines of, no, wait, how can one Democrat be doing better than another Democrat? Everybody's partisan. They already know they're going to vote for one party or another. Why is the spread wider in this race than the other? I think back to 2018 when Senator Tammy Baldwin cruised to reelection while other statewide offices, including Governor Evers, won very, very close races. there are some differences in particular races. It isn't just D's versus R's.
That's right. And it's not the case that everybody's locked in. That's an exaggeration. Democrats and Republicans are. About 90% of Democrats and Republicans say they're voting for their party's candidate in both the governor and the Senate race. The big difference is among independents, where Evers has a 4-point margin in the governor's race with independents, but Barnes has a 14-point advantage with independents. And these are exactly the same people answering both of these questions. It's not like they're two separate sets of people. And it just shows that independents have a different view of the Senate race than they do of the governor's race. And at the moment, that's helping Mandela Barnes, and it's a lot of the reason why he's up by 7.
We're looking at the new Marquette University Law School poll, first since the primary elections in Wisconsin, looking at the big races and coming up the big issues that Wisconsinites are thinking about. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to hear candidates talking about? What are you worried about in the state? Or are you happy with the way things are going? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you still swayable in any of these statewide elections? Call in or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's turn to the issues. You asked voters about a bunch of issues, Charles, that they're concerned about. Number one is inflation, but it seems like that's gone down since your previous survey.
Yeah, a concern with inflation is still the number one issue of the 9 issues that we asked about. But it has risen steadily month to month since last summer. Only this time, it's down by about 8 points from 75% in June to 67% now that are very concerned with it. That comes as a summer in which gas prices started to come down in the last month or two, and also where the consumer price index was flat, did not go up between June and July. You know, often economic changes are filtered by people's partisan lenses, you know, and that's still the case here. But I did find it interesting that over the summer of falling gas prices after a long, steady rise and inflation flattening out, that the public responded to that. Didn't mean that inflation went away as an issue by any stretch of the imagination, but it is interesting that the public responded to those macroeconomic changes.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jackie is with us in Pewaukee. Jackie, hello.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Jackie?
Well, I'm really glad that you're having this discussion. I've been disgusted with the commercials and especially just the mudslinging back and forth, and especially with Ron Johnson saying, oh, well, I'm going to do this and do that for Wisconsin. And it's like you've been in there for this time. What were you do? Point to what you did and give us details of how you made that happen. And I'm not seeing that. I'm just seeing blanket statements with no substance.
Jackie, thanks for the call. I can vouch for a lot of ads out there. Charles, the limited amount of streaming and YouTubing I do, I'm seeing lots of these ads. Can you talk about how the content of the ads might fit into what you're seeing people talking about on issues?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's revealing. And the differences between the parties in what they're concerned in about helps us understand some of the advertising. For Republicans, the top 4 issues are inflation, crime, taxes, and illegal immigration. But for Democrats, the top 4 are climate change, gun violence, abortion policy, and public schools. So really, the bases of the two parties are most concerned about different sets of items. Senator Johnson has been talking about illegal immigration this week, and it's notable that that's in the top 4 issues for Republicans, but it's near the bottom for Democrats, and it's relatively low for independents as well. So that's an example of talking to your party base, but maybe not talking as much about issues of most concern to independents, let alone Democrats.
Thanks for that call, Jackie. Speaking of appealing to the base, I know you try in various ways to measure you know, which base is more excited about this election? Who's more likely to turn out in this midterm year? What are you seeing right now?
Yeah, there had been a growing gap between the parties in June. But that gap largely, evaporated, here in August. We have, in terms of are you absolutely certain you're going to vote in this year's election, 83% of registered Republicans say that, but 82% of Democrats say it. It's a bit lower, 66% among independents. Likewise, when we ask if you're excited or enthusiastic about voting, those had been fairly similar in the spring, but Republicans took an advantage in June. But this month, the Republican enthusiasm didn't change, but Democrats went up 9 points, closing the gap on that as well. I would emphasize the certainty of turning out because if you vote, it doesn't really matter whether you're enthusiastic or not. It really matters whether you get to the polls. And so the absolutely certain to vote measure is a good comparison here.
We're talking to Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette University Law School poll, with us today to share results from the latest survey just out yesterday, first post-primary survey in this midterm election season. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is top of mind for you as you consider candidates? Inflation, abortion, gun violence, crime, you name it. What issues are important to you? What questions do you have about these poll results? How polling works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about results from the latest Marquette poll with the poll's director, Charles Franklin, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts headed into the midterm elections this year, the candidates, the issues on your mind. 800-642-1234 is the number. Rich joins us in Two Rivers. Rich, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on the air. The thing that is kind of puzzling to me is Johnson's ads are really deceptive and good. And I just don't know why the Democrats don't bring up how he handed Pence right before he got on, before the false electorate. I mean, they don't even bring that up. I mean, why don't they bring that up? I mean, that was deceit.
Rich, thanks for the call. Yeah, the list of the statement from the false electors from Wisconsin ended up in Ron Johnson's office possession. Still some questions about the chain of provenance there. But Charles, the sort of things that people might, the Democrats in this case, might target Ron Johnson on, including the 2020 election. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of different topics that I think maybe they test differently in the research that the campaigns do. There's a lot of baked-in opinion about any incumbent, but certainly Senator Johnson. The ads that I've paid or noticed have talked more about economic values, whether he supports the middle class or not, that Barnes does support the middle class. Those are, in a sense, more old-fashioned ads talking about concerns for a broader swath of voters. On things like the election, January 6th, and COVID, for example, there are strong opinions for and against Senator Johnson on those, but I think they may be baked in. I don't run campaigns. I'm not about to give advice to a campaign about how to advertise. But I think that is a consideration that campaigns have, is what issues might move marginal independent voters versus what issues are just reaffirming what your base voters already think. And there's a debate in campaigns about how much you want to persuade any independents to your side. And that might be one set of issues versus how much do you want to rally your side? And that might be a different set.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Charles, wanted to talk to you about the impact of Roe v. Wade. The timing suggests, hey, maybe that's what helped account for that Democratic enthusiasm gap in the elections. We saw this vote in Kansas specifically on the issue. They rejected a constitutional change there that would have allowed banning abortion in that state. How have you tried to measure the impact of the abortion issue here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we've done it several ways. Let me go through them. Democrats are more concerned about abortion. They rank it much higher, I think third highest, whereas Republicans rank it second or third from the bottom. So there's a big difference there, and that may have helped Democratic enthusiasm. When we ask about the court's abortion decision, first of all, almost everybody's heard about it, and that's the same for Republicans and Democrats. But in terms of whether you favor the court striking down Roe, only 30% favor that, 60% are opposed. We've been asking for 10 years now, should abortion be legal in all or most cases, or should it be illegal in all or most? And this month, 65% say legal in all or most, 30% say illegal in all or most. And that is a little bit of a change from June, when it was 35% saying illegal in all or most. So a 5-point decline there and a 7-point increase in the legal in all or most. So there has been a little bit of shift that had been very stable for the last 10 years. I don't want to make too much out of a 5-point shift, but coming when it does, I think it's important. Finally, I think, and this is certainly relevant to legislation, we asked, do you think Wisconsin should or should not allow a woman to obtain a legal abortion if she became pregnant as a result of rape or incest? 88% say we should allow abortion in that case. 8% should not. And that includes 79% of Republicans, 87% of independents, and 97% of Democrats. So this is a live policy debate that will be faced by the legislature next January.
Talking to Charles Franklin from the Marquette Law School Survey, director of it. New poll just came out yesterday. Let's bring on another caller. Mike is with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So with both candidates, not only Johnson but also Michaels, they both tout their long-term work history. Well, we all have worked from high school on practically, and so I don't really find much value in that. They both started up or helped to move along their companies, but what I'd like to know more about is how equitable is the pay difference between the median of their employees and the highest paid. Is that 100-1? Is it 10-1?
I gotcha, Mike. Charles, we don't have the answers to those questions in front of us now, but it gets to the issue of how do candidates tell stories about themselves and about each other?
And those stories are especially important this fall. For Tim Michaels, we asked the favorable, unfavorable question. And he's 33 favorable, 33 unfavorable, but 34 don't have an opinion about him. For Barnes, it's 37 favorable, 22 unfavorable, but 41% don't have an opinion about him. The two incumbents are much better known than that. So the challengers of both parties have the task here in the heat of the fall campaign to introduce themselves to between a third and 40% of voters for the first time. And of course, their opponents are also trying to introduce them. So very much the fall campaign for both of these challengers will be how to try to establish a positive image of themselves, even as they are criticizing their opponents.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Rhoda joins us now in Milwaukee. Rhoda, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to say thank goodness for Governor Evers and his ability to veto, because without that, wouldn't we already have permitless concealed carry in Wisconsin, which the vast majority of people do not want? If Tim Michaels is elected as governor, he's going to rubber stamp every right-wing crazy thing that the GOP legislature wants to pass.
Rhoda, thanks for the call. Charles, it's maybe a subtle point to make into a campaign ad, but this has been a key case Democrats have made to their own base anyway, that Republicans, given the way district lines are drawn, will almost certainly keep control of the legislature. The role of that governor, he's compared himself to a goalie at some points.
I think that's exactly right. With virtually no chance of the legislature changing, the real question is, do you want divided government like we've had for the last 4 years, or do you want to go back to one-party government that we had for 8 years under Governor Walker? There are many Republicans that certainly want to have unified Republican control, but there are many Democrats that now see the virtues of divided government. And I think that's a key argument for the Evers administration to make, just as it's a key argument for Republicans to argue that, you know, put us in complete control and we can get things done. We'll see which of those arguments persuades voters and carries the day.
Thanks for that call. Charles, I want to take our last minute or so on an issue that struck me in the survey. You asked about marijuana legalization and found 51%, if I read this right, support for legalization among Republicans.
Yes, this is a change that's been taking place over the last decade. We had more opposition than support for legalization 8 or 10 years ago, but it's been growing. And in the last year, Republicans for the first time have tipped over to a majority favoring legalization. It's 51-39 among Republicans now, 69-23 among the public at large. So a big public majority, but Republicans had been more opposed than in favor. But in the last year or so, that has tipped to now just a slight majority of Republicans, but of course, much bigger majorities, 75 among independents and 81 among Democrats.
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been hearing from Charles Franklin. He's a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of Marquette University's Law School Poll. He's with us today to talk about the latest results, what it could tell us about this fall's midterm elections. Follow the WPR news team and their coverage of the candidates and the issues in this fall's races. You can do that all at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, check out a unique project to track the fish species around the Apostle Islands using sail drones. Yeah, like unpersoned sailboats, drones to track the fish in Lake Superior. Sounds pretty cool. I want to hear more about it. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Speaking of survey news, here's a poll on an issue that found some agreement across partisan lines: the future of the penny. The survey group Data for Progress asked people if they wanted to get rid of our one-cent coin. Wording can matter. Here's the choice they gave. Either the U.S. government should stop producing new pennies, pennies are no longer useful in our economy, and producing them wastes millions of dollars, or the U.S. government should continue producing new pennies, pennies are an important part of our economy, and abolishing them would disrupt business in the U.S. 58% of respondents said, get rid of the pennies. The partisan split, there wasn't one. Republicans, Democrats, and independents all came in just around that 58% mark. What do you think? Should the penny stay or should it go? Email centraltime@wpr.org. That's centraltime@wpr.org, or tweet us at centraltimewpr. Give us your 2 cents. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. When Roe v. Wade was overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court back in June, it brought an 1849 law into effect in Wisconsin, banning abortions except in cases where they would be needed to save the life of the pregnant woman. A lawsuit is challenging that in part because of a later abortion law in the state. After that Supreme Court decision, clinics and support groups changed their services and their advocacy messages. We'll explore how some of those services changed on both sides of the abortion issue You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the current laws in Wisconsin, changes you'd like to see made in one direction or another. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Matt Sandy is the Legislative PAC Director for Pro-Life Wisconsin. Matt, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the legislative side of things, I know your organization and others had partnered on promoting pregnancy resource centers. Can you talk a little bit about what those are and what they do around the state?
Absolutely. Well, the pregnancy resource centers offer hope to women in crisis pregnancies. We have helped about 25 around the state, but there's a number of them all across the state. They provide free ultrasounds, free pregnancy testing. They offer parental counseling to parents, material, emotional, spiritual support to women to provide them life-saving alternatives to abortion, such as adoption or keeping their baby. And so they help them with prenatal care and postnatal care and the education that they need. For example, Women's Care Center in Milwaukee and Madison, Life's Connection in Waukesha, Vita up in the Fox Valley, A&A Alexandrina up in the Green Bay area. They're all over the state. And we're proud to partner with them, support them. About 5 years ago in 2017, we partnered with Wisconsin Family Action. We worked in the legislature to help advance a Choose Life specialty license plate. And that did pass. And then we were able to get that going. And in 2017, we started getting plates on the road. And the $25 donation goes directly to the PRCs, Pro-Life Wisconsin and Wisconsin Family Council. We cover all the administrative expenses. And we have, you know, since 2017, we have about over 2,000 plates on the road. And we've you know, given grants of over $150,000 to 25 PRCs around the state. So, yeah, we're proud to partner with them. We know that we have to do more. We have to meet the demand. Obviously, no abortions are being performed right now in Wisconsin post-Roe, thankfully. But we need to even provide more robust funding for them, not only private funds, but God willing, if we have a pro-life governor and we retain our pro-life majorities in the legislature, we can actually pass some legislation to fund them with, you know, state general purpose revenue dollars, public dollars.
Have you seen a change in demand for services at these centers or their focus since the end of Roe and then this the 1849 law coming into effect?
Absolutely. If you talk to the pregnancy resource centers, they are being inundated. A lot of women are coming in. And so, yes, their demand, their clientele has increased dramatically. And we know with the other with on the pro-abortion side with Planned Parenthood and, you know, Affiliated Medical Services in Milwaukee, they are, you know, so-called navigating women down to Illinois, where abortion is legal, to, you know, Waukegan, Aurora, and now and Rockford is starting to move to provide abortion. So we're trying to meet the demand. We're trying to steer women to our pregnancy resource centers, and we do that. And, you know, Pro-Life Wisconsin, and 40 Days for Life, we do have a presence at the abortion clinics, even though they're not providing abortions. We are down there sidewalk counseling and encouraging women to go across the street to a women's care center, particularly in Milwaukee and Madison.
Talking to Matt Sandy with Pro-Life Wisconsin, looking at Wisconsin post-Roe v. Wade. Matt, turning to legislation now, as I mentioned, that 1849 law, the only exception for abortion would be to save the life of the mother. You're hoping to change that, tweak it. What kind of changes would you like to see from the legislature?
Well, again, we would have to have a pro-life governor to make any changes. And we would be looking at next session. But there's a couple that we're looking at. There's a broad and undefined life of the mother exception in 940.04, our 1849 ban. And we would like to remove that exception and provide language requiring equal care for mother and child. and then providing immunity to the physician if he or she follows the requirement. So imagine in a medical emergency, the idea is to rush mom and baby to hospital to provide perhaps a medical emergency cesarean section, a medical emergency early induction, maybe the removal of an ectopic pregnancy. And if the baby dies there, that is not intentional. That's inadvertent. And those operations are not abortions legally. They've never been prosecuted as abortions in this country. Even under Catholic moral teaching, they're not abortions because it's not the intentional destruction of a preborn living human being. And that is what is critical. We need to understand that the term abortion, when we're talking about that in a legal sense, means the direct, intentional, you know, willful, purposeful destruction of a preborn child. That's what we see in the 1849 ban, right? It essentially says any person other than the mother who intentionally destroys the life of an unborn child is guilty of a Class H felony. If you look at our modern statutes on abortion, 25310, parent 2, parent A, abortion means the use of an instrument, medicine, drug, or other substance or device with intent to terminate the pregnancy of a woman known to be pregnant. So it deals with intention. And so what we would like to do is provide, we have good legal language to do this. There is a moral and effective way to address the mother's life in a pro-life bill. And again, it's essentially requiring the physician to provide equal care for mom and baby. There's two patients. You never want to carve out an exception for direct abortion in our statutes. You don't want to codify the importance of one innocent human life over and above another. Physicians must, you know, do their best to provide equal care. And they can do that. They use their God-given talent, skills, and abilities. We kind of step back. They try to save both. If one or the other, you know, if the baby inadvertently dies, it's not an abortion. And then you would just say that as long as they follow that requirement of equal care, they would be immunized. They would not be subject to the penalties in the pro-life bill. And we believe that's a moral and just way to address the mother's life. So I want to be very clear that the current abortion ban does not, you know, prevent a miscarriage treatment. You know, my wife and I had a miscarriage. She needed a DNC, an abortion procedure, to remove that dead baby, sadly, our dead child. And all these operations to care for the mother and the baby, even, you know, the removal of an ectopic pregnancy are all legal right now, and physicians can do them. What is prohibited is the intentional destruction of a preborn human being. And so we'd like to, that is one area where we'd like to clear up, and then I can talk about another one. But do you have a question
sure.
on that?
No, go ahead. What other changes would you like to see?
Well, when you look at 940.04, you know, and I grant that, you know, the law is a little vague, you know, on the life of the mother. That's why we want to clear it up. It doesn't define life of the mother. It doesn't define therapeutic abortion. So we want to add that legal language that I talked about, equal care for mom and baby. And there's a lack of specificity in 940.04 when it comes to, you know, the use of a medicine, drug, or chemical substance used in an abortion. We think about mifepristone, the so-called medical abortion. There's a medical abortion facility Planned Parenthood runs in Sheboygan. And it's unclear if 940.04 would ban so-called medical abortions, the mifepristone RU46 abortions. And so we would want to look at that if that specificity is needed. And there's also another problem. Even if we were to outright ban mifepristone abortions or the use or prescription of mifepristone for the intent to have an abortion, to abort the pregnancy, the baby. Again, you have this intractable problem of these drugs being mailed from out of state, maybe from pro-abortion states, even from out of country, unsupervised and undetected. And we do have a law in Wisconsin that bans telemedicine abortions where you know, to get mifepristone, the woman has to, you know, be present physically with the doctor and he or she giving it to her directly to be physically present. But I just think looking at that. And finally, I would say this issue of crossing state lines. People will say, well, you know, you have the right of free travel. Abortion is a legal medical procedure in Minneapolis and Chicago and those states. But there is this idea in Dobbs, which is very critical. Although Dobbs did not declare personhood for the preborn child, it didn't, you know, assign 14th Amendment protections of equal protection and due process from conception. it wasn't a personhood bill. It did state that there are two, you know, human beings in an abortion. And in the state of Wisconsin and other states can recognize that. And much like a state like the state of Wisconsin would not want a born child to be trafficked over state lines for sex trafficking in another state, in Chicago or Minneapolis, the state would also have an interest in not allowing a preborn child in Wisconsin from being, you know, navigated or trafficked over state lines to be killed by abortion in another state. And so the question is, how would that be enforced, or how could a prohibition on that be lawful? I know that the Thomas More Law Society in Chicago is looking at this. They did Peter Breen, one of their attorneys, who was a former state rep in Illinois, had mentioned this to Washington Post reporter. It went viral the last month. And essentially, he said that you could look at, you know, a private right of action, much akin to the Texas law, where someone could, a private citizen could sue anyone aiding and abetting anyone that's moving or trafficking or navigating a preborn child over state lines to be killed by abortion. So I guess overall, this is a real battle now at the state level. I've said, you know, when Dobbs became the rule and Roe and Casey were overturned, I just said, you know, the shackles of the Roe Casey legal regime have been thrown off. Now states are free to ban abortion without exception. Each state is going to battle this out. They're going to regulate abortion. They're going to ban it. They're going to, you know, support abortion.
And that's all the time we have. Matt Sandy was with us, Legislative PAC Director for Pro-Life Wisconsin. Thanks to him for joining us to talk about his organization's reactions to a post-Roe Wisconsin, as we just heard, their legislative agenda for the post-election era after the election this fall. We'll pick up the conversation with an advocate on the other side of the issue coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk on how abortion services have changed in what's now a post-Roe Wisconsin. Johanna Hatch is a nurse, nurse midwife, and board president for Pregnancy Options Wisconsin Education Resources and Support, or POWERS. Johanna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you talk about the services your organization provides and how it's changed now since the overturning of Roe v. Wade?
Absolutely. So POWERS is started out in 2018 kind of as an ad hoc group of nurses, midwives, doulas, physicians, and other advocates who wanted to help ensure that folks in Wisconsin had clear, accurate information about the full menu of pregnancy options, including choosing to end a pregnancy or release a pregnancy through abortion. So to that end, we have been proud to provide information about accessing abortion care, as well as accessing resources to support folks who are choosing to go through that process, whether they are seeking an abortion through a clinic or are self-managing their abortion at home.
What are the options out there for someone seeking an abortion now, again, given that, except with a very rare exception, it is not available in Wisconsin?
So for, I think, many people, the choice now becomes, if I am choosing to seek abortion care, to seek an abortion through a clinic, one will have to travel out of state. We know folks are traveling to Illinois and Minnesota, among other places, because both of those states have much, much more favorable access options than we currently have in Wisconsin. I mean, what we're seeing right now is that pretty much all access to clinical abortion care has ended in Wisconsin. And then that being said, we know that even pre-Dobbs decision, there were folks in many parts of our state who chose to access abortion pills through the internet and self-manage their abortions at home. And so we just know that folks are probably continuing to do that as well.
As someone working in the medical field, what confusion is out there for, say, doctors when someone who's pregnant is experiencing complications, for example?
So that would be a difficult question for me to answer, because the state of Wisconsin, even pre-Dobbs, precludes advanced practice clinicians such as myself from providing abortion care, though we are qualified by our training. So that's a law in Wisconsin that will also have to be dealt with at some point. But I know, as a nurse who helped provide this care and worked in abortion care in the past, that providers who provide abortions are always, they are people who are extremely compassionate, extremely skilled, extremely careful, but also extremely aware of the litigious nature of those who oppose abortion care. And so I think for many physicians who have been providing abortion care in Wisconsin have pretty much just, it has all but stopped because there is not, there's a pretty clear legal guidance that they should not be providing it. But I do know that it can delay appropriate care for folks who need it if there are laws that essentially ban providers from giving that care.
Talking to Johanna Hatch, nurse, student nurse midwife, and board president for Pregnancy Options Wisconsin Education Resources and Support. We just heard the case from Pro-Life Wisconsin for changes in Wisconsin law. They'd like to see tightening up, in effect, the life of the mother exception, cracking down on travel beyond state lines and medication abortions. Do you have your eye on a possible change you'd like to see with this 1849 law now in effect?
Yes. I would say, you know, Powers, we are primarily a service delivery organization and seek to provide support. So we don't have a specific legislative agenda. We aren't doing advocacy. But I think the first step is that 1849 law has to be dealt with and needs to be taken away. There are also a number of other laws prior to the Dobbs decision that made Wisconsin an extremely hostile place for folks who are seeking abortion care. Laws like the 24-hour mandatory waiting period that required 2 in-person visits to clinics, the really like nonsensical requirement that somebody has to be physically present with a physician in order to take mifepristone or part of the medication abortion regimen, and also that it has to be the same physician that did their first consenting appointment at least 24 hours prior, as well as laws that restrict advanced practice clinicians such as myself from providing abortion care, even though it is a part of our scope of practice. So all of those things would also like really help increase access throughout the state for folks seeking abortion care. But first, we got to get rid of that 1849 law.
Now, in the last couple of months, what kind of things are you hearing? What kind of demand for services are you getting from women here in Wisconsin?
So we've always been, you know, a place where folks could seek support as they're going through their decision-making process or support after they've made a decision about whether to continue a pregnancy, make an adoption plan, or release a pregnancy through abortion care. So we continue to provide that kind of full spectrum support. We also know that folks have always had trouble seeking or accessing abortion care in an equitable way, including things like the cost of travel, taking time off, childcare. And those needs are only now even more acute now that folks have to travel even further out of state in order to access this really basic health care.
Now that women are traveling across state lines, what kind of things do they encounter? I assume each state works differently, even when abortion remains legal. Can you talk about what it's like to navigate that across state lines?
Well, I would say I'm really grateful for our neighbors in Illinois and Minnesota. You know, Minnesota's state Supreme Court just updated a lot of their laws regarding abortion care. So folks who travel to Minnesota or Illinois are not subject to any sort of mandatory waiting period. Their care can be completed in one office visit, so they do not have to make multiple trips to the clinic. But even with that, you know, the closest clinic in Illinois, I believe, is about 2.5 hours from Madison. And then, you know, in Minnesota, the closest clinics are in the Twin Cities and Duluth. So it really does vary for folks coming from different parts of Wisconsin how far they are going to have to travel and how that's going to impact things like how many days they have to take off of work, whether or not they need to get a hotel, you know, who's going to care for their kids, all those kinds of things.
Are you concerned that laws could change to make it illegal to help with that kind of coordination across state lines?
Yeah, that is very worrisome in listening to your last guest and hearing kind of his vision for the future of Wisconsin. And I think it would be really easy to say that, like, we would oppose any of those measures. Our motto, the principle that we operate under is trust pregnant people. We believe that pregnant people are the best authorities on their lives and their health care. And they are full people with full civil rights. They should be free to travel, move as across state lines as much as anybody else. And the idea of taking away the civil constitutional rights of pregnant people even further to essentially trap them in Wisconsin against their will is yeah, definitely something that we would strongly oppose.
In just our last half a minute or so, what are the biggest unanswered questions for you right now?
You know, I think for us, some of the biggest questions are just, you know, like these attacks on the sovereignty and autonomy of pregnant people in the state of Wisconsin. You know, I think this is just one step here, you know, with the loss of the protection of Roe versus Wade, we're reverting back to these 1849 laws that I think are putting physicians and other healthcare practitioners in a really awful space of having to first think about, you know, what's the law say before we think about what is best for this person that I'm caring for and what do they know that they need for their lives. I think we are just going to continue to work to help people access the full spectrum of pregnancy options, you know, including continuing pregnancies, safe places of birth, the healthcare practitioner of an individual's choice, as well as helping people navigate these systems in order to access abortion care, because we trust pregnant people.
Johanna, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Johanna Hatch, nurse midwife, and board president for Pregnancy Options Wisconsin Education, Resources, and Support, or POWERS. She joined us today to talk about how abortion services have changed in Wisconsin following the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Earlier, we heard from Pro-Life Wisconsin. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.